Now, I would like to thank very warmly the Arts Council of England and indeed, of course, the Friends of the Festival for sponsoring this event. Your support is absolutely invaluable, so thank you. Now, back to our speaker. James Booth's career has been, and still is, academic and scholarly, and for the most part, he lectured in English literature at Hull University, where, of course, one of his colleagues was the chief librarian there, Philip Larkin. However, I must mention in passing that James's expertise is not confined to poems and Ing Lit, because he is also a notable authority on ancient coins, specifically those of the Anglo-Saxon period and then moving up into the Normans and the Plantagenets. And he has written certainly at least two books on the subject. So if anybody just happens to have an ancient coin in their pocket that needs authenticating, then James is your man. However, we're not here this afternoon to discuss old coins, but rather to consider the poetry of Philip Larkin and, of course, to consider to the quite remarkable biography that James has produced. Now, personally, I believe this biography to be the definitive one. Now, I suppose one shouldn't really say that, but that's what I certainly feel. The reason being that it works on every possible level, in that it delves deeply into Larkin's character, his attitudes, and his complexities. It probes with tremendous sensitivity the mechanics of the verse itself, especially those splendid auditory effects. It is wide and deep in scope. The delivery is very lively and animated, and in places it is extremely funny. So one might say, what else does one want other than the author himself, James Booth?
Over to you, or do you want me to give you a question?
Give me a question.
Give you a question. Okay. Now, Larkin has this popular image of being rather a curmudgeonly misogynist, difficult, truculent, sometimes dour, gloomy, acerbic, etc., etc. One could say that he's often presented as a sort of Eeyore donkey in a field. And yet, surprisingly, he can also appear as Pooh Bear, friendly, affable, matey. And I wonder if you found this in your researches.
Well, you're right, of course. He is all the things you said, and some of his most famous lines very much play up to this image. Life is first boredom, then fear. Whether or not we use it, it goes and leaves what something hidden from us chose, and age, and then the only end of age. And, at the end of a late letter, he says, gloomy sod, aren't I? Talking about the next election where he thinks Labour's going to win and so on. But, of course, as I say, he's playing up to it. There is this sense which everything that Larkin writes, I think, even at his most profound and sincere, I don't think there's anything insincere about life is first boredom, yet fear. Yet everyone will smile at the end of that phrase. It's lugubrious rather than earth-shatteringly philosophical, as it were. He's good at getting a tone which has richness in it, different levels in it, and always with a sense of inverted commas around it. So he can do so many different things. He can he can work on so many different levels. He himself said, I mean, he had quite a simple philosophy of poetry as sincere utterance. He put a photograph of Thomas Hardy at the beginning of his seventh workbook, or perhaps it's the sixth, and underneath it, the aim of the poet is to move his reader's hearts by showing his own. And that's what he does. But of course, that can include, they fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They give you all the thoughts they had and leave some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by silly fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. That's just as sincere as the end of an Arundel tune. Time has transfigured them into untruth. The stone fidelity they hardly meant has come to be their only blazon, and to prove our almost instinct, almost true, what will survive of us is love. He is all things to all men, as people say, Shakespeare is. I think this is part of, this is greatness. Mm. He's got empathy all over the place with everyone, with a rabbit in a field dying of myxomatosis, with his American biographer getting bored with this old fart, the English fart he's got to write a biography of. That's the subtlety of it. He's very good at doing himself down as well. Gloomy old sod, aren't I? You know, at the end of one of the letters. And he's his own worst critic, which does cause him some trouble. The problem I found writing the biography, though, talking about popular images, was, of course, and you've half referred to it by mentioning, or sort of glancingly referring to the earlier biography, Andrew Motion's biography, 1992, followed by the selected letters edited by Anthony Thwaite. Because somehow or other, at that point, and I don't think it was wholly either Andrew's fault or Anthony's fault, a very nasty image of Larkin became current. Mm. Larkin was not a nice man. Larkin was a nasty man. He was deeply unpleasant. And this has flourished until quite recently. When the Complete Poems came out, one critic wrote in a major paper that reading the notes to Archie Burnett's edition just proved what a shit Larkin was in real life. And you've got Tom Paulin's famous statement that when the letters came out and you saw bits of what seems like, and probably is really, racism in one or two of the letters to some of his correspondent, and also the idea that he treated women very badly, I'll get onto that again in a minute, I can't really get to, be able to get off that one, showed that he was a nasty bit of goods. The sewer under the National Monument. There's Paulin's beautiful phrase, which has gone down in history, really. We have now discovered the sewer under the National Monument. Alan Bennett wrote that he thought of Larkin as an intimate, familiar pal, P-A-L, that's his initials, Philip Arthur Larkin. But now he felt really betrayed because he'd realised that he'd treated Maeve very badly. That's what Bennett felt most badly about. And Maeve actually considered suing him over his review of the biography because she thought he got it completely wrong, which he had. Alan Bennett does get Larkin wrong quite significantly. There was a headline in a paper about an interview that Andrew Motion gave about that time, 1992-1993, Mr. Nice meets Mr. Nasty. So when I was doing the research for my book, I came across the Larkin I was familiar with, but more intimately, all the people who'd known Larkin, particularly being in Hull, there are a lot of them still left. Some of them are still alive. His secretary, Betty, is 90 and she's still there. And they all remembered him as a really nice man. Everyone. I haven't yet... When the book came out, I thought, now I'll get some letters coming in, say, he snubbed me. And there was that occasion when he was so nasty to that Indian chap. You know, it shows what a racist he was. Nothing. Absolutely nothing has come in. The opposite. The more and more stuff has come in saying, what an absolutely nice, polite, decent chap he was, whatever context you met him, and he went out of his way to be nice to you. So I got rather puzzled. And I expected, well, I had to be very careful writing the book, not actually to make it too much a kind of apologia, you know, to start trying to prove these people wrong. And sure enough, when it came out, there were a few people popped up with the old Larkin, sort of caricature, cartoon Larkin, really, this Mr. Nasty Larkin, who was very bad to women and was a racist and was a nasty bit of goods and was very right-wing and hadn't got any feelings. That's the main thing that people say. This is what you get from Martin Amis. He says that he was dried up. And his life was lacking in sap, you know. He put all his emotion into the poetry because he hadn't got any in his real life. So my favourite review, actually, was in The Observer by Rachel Cook, who was actually quite sensible. I heard her on the radio last week, and she was saying quite sensible things, but her review of me wasn't so sensible, I don't think. She said, and now comes along, you know, we all know what Larkin's like, because that's the problem with this view. It just goes without any evidence, you see, really. We all know what Larkin's like. And now here comes along this retired professor of English from Hull University. Oh, that's a real put-down. You know, obviously, he can't be trusted. James Booth, eager to dispel the stink with the literary equivalent of air freshener, attempting to dispel every trace of whiffiness. I thought I must hire her as my publicity woman. It's so good. But that doesn't work anymore. Mm. She was a lone voice, but there's so few of them left, I think. And I'm hoping that this is going to be the end of it.
Yes, I was going to say, that is such a wonderfully sort of glib comment to make about Larkin. And you imagine that she must have enjoyed herself immensely in baying against him in that way, as indeed would Martin Amis have done.
Yes.
Because what struck me about Larkin, and comes out in your over and over again, is the man's essential humanity.
Yes.
He was a kind person.
And interestingly, from that point of view, he's giving them their ammunition because by acting up to that image himself and enjoying it, he enjoys doing it. When in that famous Monitor film where he walks up the stairs into the library and then takes a book into the corner and looks over the top of it, like Dracula, you know. He's really enjoying it. But he's expecting his viewers to realise that he's got all the other... That's why he can do it, because he's got all the other dimensions, as you say. He's got a kind of human sense of the complexity of this kind of thing, which is why he can be so funny and so moving, and why, in a sense, the two guarantee each other. The fact that he can write... they fuck you up, your mum and dad, in a way guarantees the emotion of the end of An Arundel Tomb. You don't feel, as you might sometimes say with Heaney or someone like that, that it's all too much on an elevated level. You know, he's an earthy chap down here with us as well, as it were, maybe.
And it's the extraordinary sort of psychological perceptions as well. I mean, in that brilliant poem, Afternoons, about the young mothers and their children in the park and so on, and that line about what is it that they are pushed to the side of their own lives.
Something is pushing them to the side of their own lives. He's so good at phrases like that. Mm. And that, of course, I mean, ultimately, that is... the key to his greatness as a poet. It's a verbal thing. The poems are poems. They're made with words. And if you're going to move the reader with your words, then it's got to work through the words. So many poets seem to think they can just get by the words. The words come out spontaneously and they don't want to touch them after they put them down because that's the pure emotion. No, you've got to calculate. You've got to know how to do it. Larkin seems to have known that from his earliest writings in his early teens. He's so mature when he starts. His earliest work is so much more advanced than most poets. But his literary verbal sensitivity is uncanny. I'm surprised, actually. I'm disappointed, really, that something which I think is a real aperçu in my book, which no one else has noticed until... I came along, really, although some people, the chap who did the Concordance of Larkin, a chap called D.C. Watt, I think his name is, he has noticed it and seen it. And when he read what I wrote about it, he said he got a creeping sensation down the back of his neck. Larkin's sensitivity to words is really uncanny. He uses words once and once only. Now you think, okay, spray-haired, unmolesting, fishy-smelling, you're only going to use that word once, aren't you? even perhaps, I don't know, fulfillment, desolate. Are you only going to use those words once? If you're like Larkin and you're often writing about being in a room on your own and looking out, are you going to use the word attic only once in one poem and then never again? He uses it in Deceptions in 1950, that final last line where the rapist comes into the room where the girl he's raped is waiting for him to, start to, her fallen life, to burst into fulfillment's desolate attic. And you think, what a resonant phrase. Attic, he's used the word. It has now, every time you think of the word attic and Larkin, you've got to think of that poem. There isn't another one to think of. The second time he uses it is attics. In the same year, absences, such attics cleared of me, such absences, after a long description of a seascape and a skyscape. A beautiful natural description. Sublime, symbolist, upbeat. So one of them is masculine, sordid, violent, nasty attic. The other one is sublime, sexless, reaching beyond transcendent attics. And then after 1950, he knows, I must not use attic again. He puts it in one other poem, which he actually titled himself Unfinished Poem as a kind of joke, because it's deliberately unfinished. And it's a lovely phrase, emaciate attic. He has a kind of Waiting for Godot figure sitting in his room waiting for death to come up the stair in his emaciate attic with his newspapers over the bed and so on. But he didn't publish it. He knew he mustn't publish it because it would spoil the other two. So,
what sacrifice.
I mean, that sounds wrong, doesn't it? It sounds like it couldn't be. But take another example. Unsatisfactory. Mm. Now, that's a Larkin-esque word, isn't it? Mm. Unsatisfactory.
Yes.
He uses it four times, but all in the same poem. And then he never uses it again. In 1958, it's in Reference Back, which ends with that amazing... I mean, people talk about, as you said, talking about him being downbeat and glum and so on. Mm. But, yes, OK, glum perhaps, but, well, it isn't glum, is it? He can be the most elevatedly eloquent poet of the century. Who else would have risked something like the end of that poem? Truly, though our element is time, we are not suited to the long perspectives open at each instant of our lives. They link us to our losses. Worse, they show us what we have as it once was, blindingly undiminished, just as though, by acting differently, we could have kept it so. Amazing. So he uses unsatisfactory in that poem, talking about his relationship with his mother. And then he knows he mustn't use it again. Extinction. Now, there's a word. He writes lots of moody poems in his Yeatsian vein at the beginning in the 40s about death. He never uses the word extinction. You think, he's a young poet. He's going to use every good word he's got, isn't he? No, he's not. He's Larkin. He knows that that is a 1,000-watt word, you know. And he's not yet up to writing a 1,000-watt poem. So he doesn't use it until he gets to the Old Fools, Extinction's Alp. And that's one usage of it in a noun phrase, Extinction's Alp. And then he's still got enough different nuance in the syntax and grammar that you could use around the word to use it one more time. He uses it in O Bard, the sure extinction that we travel to and shall be lost in always. So when you think of the word extinction, it's only those two poems. He hasn't used it before because he knows he mustn't. It's really uncanny. A word like welcome, he uses it only once. Useful, he uses it only useful to get that learned, comes in Wild Oats. So someone who's read his poetry and becomes familiar with it knows. And so he can even play tricks which no other poet would be able to do. In The Trees, it ends, how's The Trees end? Begin again, begin afresh, begin again, no, begin afresh, afresh, afresh. The trees are coming into leaf. The unresting castles thresh, begin afresh, afresh, afresh. Now, he knew that that was going to become an irresistible anthology piece. And being Larkin, that made him dissatisfied with it. He thought, no, this is too, you know, it's too easy. It's rhetorical. It's like High Windows compared with Sad Steps, if you look at those two poems. Sad Steps is such a greater poem than High Windows. It's the same poem, just shifted on its axis and turned into a different thing. He's really good at that, working within his own oeuvre. And he can expect his readers to know the previous one. So by the time he wrote O Bard, the trees had become a familiar anthology piece. So he has unresting death a whole day nearer now. So the unresting castles thresh, saying begin again. You know, but now in O Bard, the unresting death a whole day nearer now flashes afresh. And he puts the two words together, and he knows, as so many readers have done, that they'll think of the trees and they'll get the point, and it will be such a terrible kind of intensification of the dread in O Bard to have that reference. Now, that kind of verbal sensitivity, he said in an interview that in his early unfinished novels in the late 40s, he said they were rather like poems. I was very careful about the way I used words. If I used a word on page 15, I didn't use it again on page 115. So he knew what he was doing. And when he came on to poetry, he did it even more. And if you look at the swear words, they're all there, fuck, sod, shit, and so on, but all in the only grammatical ways that they're used. And he goes through all of them in the right, not in the right order, but he ticks them all off. They're almost all there, even a fuck, as it were, which comes at the end. And only in one poem, and they're each different, and they each have a different nuance. And that's then the word used up for him. Which actually makes me feel this is why Motion is wrong when he says that Larkin gave up on poetry, and it was a kind of willful suicide as a poet, which he sort of seems moralistic about it. I think Larkin simply ran out. His words were used. His thesaurus was so deeply organic, and his life was so intricated into the words. But I haven't talked about his other
words. I was going to say that the word intricate strikes a bell with me because in the course of your researches and writing this biography, you must, pleasurable though it would have been, it must have also at times been quite masochistic that you will have encountered various problems, difficulties, frustrations perhaps. And I was wondering what was perhaps one of your major challenges, if you had any real challenges.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure you did, but was there anything that really bugged you in the course of writing it?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. I think, comparatively speaking, compared with most biographers, in a few of the really central problems that biographers tend to have, I've had a really easy ride of it. One thing is that, unlike, say, Hughes or Plath, you know, if you want to write about either of those, or quite a few other poets, you've immediately got the relatives, the widow, the daughter, and so on. Absolutely, you know, you'll know the Silent Woman by Jacqueline Rose, which was a book on Sylvia Plath. And she wrote it all, and then the estate said, you're not allowed to quote anything from Sylvia Plath, because Ted Hughes' estate says you can't, and it belongs to Ted Hughes' estate. And you think, not quote any poetry from Sylvia Plath in a book on Sylvia Plath, because Ted Hughes' estate tells you you can't. You know, whatever your views on feminism and that relationship and so on, there's a problem there, isn't there? Whereas I had nothing of that. Larkin has no... in fact, his literary estate is run by the Society of Authors, so I have a totally professional relationship. There's no problem at all. The people were interesting. Maeve was very, very reticent with me. I edited her memoir of Larkin. I was very, very careful not to change, even when I thought, goodness me, she's got that wrong, you know. And she explained how he'd written a poem and read it to her and so on, and what she'd thought of it at the time. I thought, yes, okay, but she's got it fundamentally wrong. But I wouldn't, you know, but she was very, very reticent, I think, because she felt that she'd been too open with Andrew Motion in the late 90s. She actually thought of suing him as well, was Alan Bennett, briefly. Only briefly, though, I don't think she really meant it. So there was a sort of difficulty there, which is still there, because one doesn't really know what happened between them, and probably one never will, simply because of the way she was. Other people, I mean, I interviewed Monica too late, so but I could get a first-hand impression there, and there isn't so much difficulty there, because they're all the letters and so on. So what are my main problems? Well, the problem, I suppose, was wrestling with what I've said already, wrestling with the myth and trying to keep my balance without being strident, but talking about the Larkin I could actually see rather than the Larkin that so many people out there thought was the real Larkin. And the Larkin which, unfortunately, Larkin himself did quite often feed. He often makes himself look like that. So that was... That was the main problem, I think.
I think that perhaps people who take themselves very seriously, as I suspect some of the critics did and do, have great difficulty in understanding somebody who does not take himself very seriously.
That is so profound. Yes, that's so profound. If Larkin had taken himself more seriously, he would not have been such a great poet.
Yeah,
it's a paradox.
Yes.
Which doesn't mean that he isn't the most serious of poets, because of course he is. That's the way to be even more serious if you deep down want to be. The nicest thing anyone said about my book was Clive James. Ooh. Who said that I understood Larkin's jokes, and so few people did. I think this is the main problem I think with Andrew Motion's biography, that he's got a sense of humour, but it isn't Larkin's, and he doesn't get a lot of the ironies that Larkin is layering into his presentation of himself. Clive James went on to make the racist comment that this is why so many Americans don't understand Larkin, because they like sincerity.
Writ large.
And you get a poet like Larkin who writes something like, get stewed, books are a load of crap. Yeah. And you get the earnest schoolteacherly attitude to that, which is, of course, it's a persona. It's this person who's been reading cowboy stories and detective novels and who's got no real literary sensibility at all. So... it's really a satirical poem mocking the speaker. And then you think, Larkin had been deluded by books. You know, he'd read Yeats and realised that Yeats was just a boring old fart farting out his histrionic rubbish, as he said later on. He'd been disillusioned.
Tell that to Roy Forster on Friday.
I'll be there on Friday to tell him. Was it? Yes, that boring old Yeats farting out his histrionic rubbish. He said that when he was drunk, in one of the very few readings he ever gave, and obviously he didn't quite mean it as badly as that, although perhaps he did. But that means, when you really think about it, he knew he'd got to put somewhere in his oeuvre, and this is the other point about him, which is so, when you make comparisons, and I must, if we've got time, just talk about his love life and Amos and Ted Hughes and so on, what was I on?
His love life.
No, I hadn't got onto that. Oh, that's right, he was a librarian. Had he not written a single poem, he would have a quite distinguished reputation as the pioneering librarian with the first really big, developed new library of post-war, the post-war education system. A story that the old professor in my department used to say. He'd been along to a conference. This is in the 60s or 70s, when, you know, in the middle of Larkin's career. And they'd started to talk about Larkin and said how good he was. And some chap came in and joined in enthusiastically. They got, went on for sentence after sentence. And this chap got more and more puzzled. And he said, "What are you talking about? We're talking about the poetry." And he said, "Is he a poet?" He said, "I meant his work in the library in Hull." So he was a great librarian. Obviously, can you imagine Amos being a great librarian and actually holding down the job? But they hold it against him. Seamus Heaney thinks it means he's less of a poet. He's a 9-to-5 man who saw poetry but couldn't really write it, unlike Seamus Heaney, who, of course, ascends to... Anyway, there's a kind of war going on between Heaney and Larkin all the way. Read Heaney's three essays on Larkin. They're very subtle denigration jobs in order to make Heaney look like the real thing. Now, the point about, I was saying, the love life. Yeah, I must say, sorry, this is not in answer to a question, but I've got to get it in. The main thing about Larkin's nastiness was he treats women very badly. As you started off by saying, he's misogynistic. How can a man...
I didn't
like
say
him?
He was. No, I said that he sometimes... Exactly.
Yeah, he thought he was misogynistic. And this is an image. But he had. I mean, a man who writes love songs in age, mm. where there's a widow, finds her old love songs. She looks at them, she cracks up, and then again another wave of memory comes. But even more... the glare of that much-mentioned brilliance, love, broke out to show its bright incipience sailing above, still promising to solve and satisfy and set unchangeably in order. So to pile them back to cry was hard without admitting how it had not done so then and could not now. How can that man be a misogynist? I mean, absolutely. Mm. He's the least misogynistic. His problem with women was he got too involved with them. And if you look at his love life, it's the most meticulous one. Comparing with Betjeman, who had a mistress all his life, made his wife's life absolutely miserable. Kingsley Amis used to knock off every possible woman he could, leave poor Hilly at home with the babies, you know, while he just went from woman to woman. Ted Hughes, who was a jack of the lad, I mean, okay, he had the two tragedies which make everyone take it much more seriously, but actually he was just the same as Amis to begin with. Any woman he came across, you know, he'd try and knock off. Unfortunately, Sylvia Plath came along and woke him up. But then, you know, to lose two wives to suicide is really just a bit, you know. And then think of even someone like T.S. Eliot, who puts his wife in an institution and never visits her. You think, well, you can put that in a different way. But make the comparison. And yet it's Larkin who gets the reputation of being witty, of being, you know, he has this special vocabulary that people use about him. That obviously his love life is terribly sordid, isn't it? Well... his first love was Ruth Bowman, who died 2 years ago, and I managed to interview, and who ended up writing a delightful children's story called Barlow Dale's Casebook about a Persian cat who's a detective. It's a your kind of thing, actually, in a way. It's really a good thing, a really good book. But that was much later. He met her when she was 16. Very carefully, decorously, they didn't have sex till she was 18. He was librarian at Wellington at the time. He was very, very chary about it after that. He didn't want to get her pregnant. That was the problem. He got engaged to her in 1948. Then when he met Monica Jones, when he moved to Leicester, he was careful to break off all relations with Ruth before he moved on to Monica. You know, you can see which month it was in 1949. I think it was June to August or something like that. So he's quite meticulous. Then... effectively, he's monogamously true to Monica for the next 25 years, except for 16 months when a very wealthy, determined woman called Patsy Strang, the South African diamond heiress, seduced him. She was determined to have a romantic relationship with a poet. She ended up marrying Richard Murphy.
Oh, right.
She moved on to another one. She... inveigled him. He was a bit uncomfortable. Well, a bit. He was very uncomfortable with it the whole time, actually. He, being the loyal, gallant man he was, if you read the letters, he keeps saying how wonderful it was. We had such a marvellous time. But they read between the lines. He's very... when it's ended, he's obviously relieved. So, apart from that, for 25 years, he's true to Monica. Till 1975. But except that in 1960... he develops this muse relationship with Maeve. So he has his muse close to him in the library and his quasi-wife hundreds and hundreds of miles away in Leicester. It's typical Larkin, be perverse, you know. And Monica obviously was very jealous, but he didn't have sex with Monica, with Maeve, because she was a Catholic who wouldn't have premarital sex. So he kept trying to explain to Monica this, that it was okay. Obviously it wasn't really okay emotionally, but, you know, by the standards that usually one uses of relationships like this, it was, you know, it was complicated rather than just exploitative. You know, he wasn't predatory. And then, very interestingly, and this is the one I really like, and I don't blame him a bit, and neither does Betty. His secretary, Betty, had been his secretary for 18 years. Maeve suddenly started to blow hot and says she had full sexual relations with him. This is terribly difficult to talk about, but at that time, I'm pretty sure from Jean Hartley and who else, someone else who told me who would have known, that Larkin was really plunging into impotence in his early 50s. He wasn't really up to much. Maeve wouldn't have necessarily been very aware of this. She wouldn't have picked it up. So she says, I surrendered and we had sex on very rare occasions when I could get over my feeling for the sacraments and so on, but only now and then. So she said this only quite late after Andrew Motion had been asking her questions for years. So again, it's rather problematic. And at that point, he deliberately seduces Betty, his secretary of 18 years. They're both 52, 53. And they have a blissful kind of clandestine relationship for the rest of their lives, really. Betty doesn't regret it for a second. She said she was really pleased when it happened. Okay, so he's three-timing women at that time. Now, is it worse than the others? That's all I'm going to say.
What comes out in your book about all these women, etc., is actually his tremendous sense of concern for them and responsibility.
Yes.
And that he is really torn. Yes. You know, he does feel sort of guilty and concerned and worried, etc. In fact, it reminded me tremendously of Graham Greene's superb novel, The Heart of the Matter, where you have Major Scobie, who is torn between his rather dreary wife, Louise, and the very young girl, 17-year-old girl, who becomes his mistress. And both of them absolutely, more or less, destroy him. They don't mean to, but he destroys himself through his sense of guilt and concern. And
interestingly, I don't think I mentioned it, Larkin does actually talk about that novel in his letters.
Oh, does he? I wonder.
He is responding to the portrayal of Scobie being torn up by this kind of thing. But you're absolutely right. Yeah. He loved women too well, you know, as like Byron, who's often got wrong in this way. He said he mustn't get too involved with Teresa Guiccioli because he might fall in love with her. And of course he did, and that screwed everything up because, you know, although, I mean, Byron's a different character altogether, he was promiscuous, but there is a level which is ignored with Larkin, and where someone like Amis just gets let off, you know, he was a bit of a lad, but everyone was in those days, he just tried to screw every woman he came across in a predatory way without even thinking about it. Larkin, I mean, one thing, shall I quote it? There's something which isn't in the complete poems because Larkin never wrote it down, but he said it to Anthony Thwaite, who said it to me, and it sounds like one of the things that would horrify people morally. When you think of the morality of it, it's actually very sophisticated. It's this: to shoot your spunk into a girl. He wrote this when he's quite young. To shoot your spunk into a girl is life's undoubted crown. But leading up to it is not, and nor is leading down. Now, Amis couldn't have written that, because he wouldn't have had any conception of leading up to it or leading down. He'd just barge in, and if he could have sex with the girl, that was it. You know, forget about her then the next day. You know. But Larkin, no.
It's quite thinking, reflective.
I've got to do it, you know, I've got to take into account what I've done to this girl. And that's your point, isn't it? I think it's right.
And I think, too, that getting away from the sexual aspects a little bit and onto, well, a great big bit, and onto his mother.
His mother, you see, this is the
thing. I mean, he has an extraordinary relationship with her. And well, so caring and kind.
And Love Songs in Age, of course, is his mother. And Truly, Though Our Element Is Time, is one of the poems about his mother. As typically with Larkin, I think you could say there are only three poems very specifically focused on his mother, but they're great. You know, there's a Summer, Autumn, what's it called? Autumn, Mother, Me, I think, what's it called? And Reference Back, and then Love Songs in Aid. But then they're great. As always with Larkin, I used to notice that when I taught him. You think, you've got your students, and you do a poem, and you really get into it. You think, let's move on to another one. Let's do another poem like Ambulances. Let's find another poem like An Arundel Tomb. Let's do another poem like Whitsmith. And you can't do it. There isn't another poem like any of those. They're all sui generis. They're almost every poem of Larkin's is a genre, with its own language, its own vocabulary, its own rhymes. His unrhymed poems. Afternoons, is it rhymed?
I can't remember now.
You'd think it was, wouldn't you?
It's the rhythm, though, isn't it?
It isn't rhymed, you're right. Obviously, you've got a really good ear. Because most people, I remembered it as rhymed, but it isn't rhymed. It's the most mellifluous poem, but it's almost as a perverse thing. He's written his most mellifluous poem without any rhymes. But then you read The Mower or Solar, and they're not rhymed absolutely deliberately. And you can tell why. You read them and you think, this is not rhymed because it's austere. This is not rhymed because it's not trivial. It's not got the jingling sound of like endings, as Milton called rhymes. that's Solar. And then when you get rhymes, you get the difference between here, which has got pheasants rhyming with presence, solitude rhyming with mud, and meadows rhyming with shadows, rich, kind of inventive, peculiar. And then you've got Mr. Bleaney. How does it go? Frayed sill, stayed till... and so on. It goes on the same. Yes. Monosyllabic rhymes, short.
And turning over his failures in a bed of lobelias.
He's brilliant at misrhymes.
Yeah,
that's a different thing altogether, you see.
Yeah.
You get the misrhymes. Mm. Sometimes he can use misrhymes to do very, very subtle things. If you read Best Society, it's full of half rhymes. And they're beautifully mellifluous in a slightly edgy way because it's an egotistical poem about shutting yourself in your room on your own. And it's beautiful. But then you get rhymes, as you say, like failures and lobelias, which are absolutely gorgeous. Mm, yeah. And then...
again, we're back to the humanity, because you get this wonderful image of these poor old men in the parks in the afternoon, staring disconsolately at this bed of lobelias. Yes. What are they thinking about? Thinking about their failures.
It's uncanny, isn't it? It's like...
So good.
It is like Shakespeare, in a way, in that there's the short circuit between the word... and the feeling and the emotion is a bit uncanny. Mm. You know, as I was saying about the way he only uses words once, that there is something deep in his consciousness here that other poets don't have. It's perhaps it's like Mozart's ability to hear 16th tones, you know. Mm. He got an ear, which meant that he was doing things that no other poet would be able to try to do because they couldn't imagine getting their readers to see what they were doing. Mm. But Larkin is doing that almost effortlessly all the time. But as you say, it's because the words seem... He manages to get from the sincerity of the emotion to move your readers' hearts by showing your own. Mm. You don't doubt that he is showing his own heart. He is sincere. Okay, he's a very varied and interesting man, so he can be just as sincere when he's being self-critical or The Trees, for instance, which is such a beautiful poem, became an anthology piece. He wrote at the end. What did you write?
I don't
a fucking awful piss, I think.
Oh, I see.
And then after that, Hardy's birthday, 2nd of July, 1958, or whatever it was. So he's moving vertiginously from one level to another. You know, as he writes, he thinks I've written this sweet poem that everyone's going to like, and it means I'm no good really. But then it's like Hardy. So
I'm going to just pause and say that there will be time for questions in a moment, but before we get on to that, one last question for you.
You.
I know this sounds a bit simplistic, but excuse me.
Okay.
Of his poems, have you got a personal favourite? I don't mean one that you think is, you know, the best in terms of quality, but which really does ring a bell for you.
Yes. There's one that I particularly like for very personal reasons. I've sat in Waterstones bookshop in Hull before Christmas twice, end of last year, and people would walk past sort of avoiding my eye when they saw it was poetry or whatever. And occasionally they'd engage me in a bit of conversation. And I think I sold two or three books each on each occasion. It wasn't bad, actually, for two or three hours' work. You know, I thought I'd made my money, you know, in a way. But on two occasions, women readers turned up. In one case, I think it was a mother and a daughter. In another case, it was obviously two women together. And I tried to sell them my book by doing a bit of, you know, a bit of emoting and so on. And I looked into their eyes and recited one of Larkin's most beautiful love poems, because he writes the most beautiful love poems. I mean, his love poetry is miraculous, and it's different. Every one is different. I mean, the Monica love poem, the great one, of course, is talking in bed, which is 10 lines, I think it is. It's the most common concentrated poem you could imagine. Anyway, this one is to Betty, the late one, the one he had the affair with his secretary in 1975. After they'd been out to dinner, he took her home and said, "Aren't you going to invite me in for coffee?" And she thought, "I don't know." And she said, "Nothing happened that night except he broke a saucer." And I thought, "Well, that's interesting. Did he do it deliberately to show I'm a man? I can just sort of come in. Or was it an accident? He was feeling awkward." Anyway, but then it moved on. Here's the poem. She then used to visit him after she used to finish badminton. She was very sporty. In fact, she was playing golf until her 80s. She's 90 now. And she would come along after showering after badminton, and then she would visit him. And then he speaks, the poem is spoken in the morning about a night before. Having said that, it could have been written by an 18-year-old man about his gay... There's nothing in the poem that tells you that. But anyway, it's been snowing. Morning at last, there in the snow, your small blunt footprints come and go. Night has left no more to show, not the candle, half-drunk wine, or touching joy. Only this sign of your life walking into mine. But when they vanish with the rain, what morning woke to will remain, whether as happiness or pain.
Yes.
And it's so beautiful, and it's so simple, and it's got that technical individualism that, you know, it's unique. It just has three rhymes, O-O-O, I-I-I, A-A-A. So it's a formula of a sigh.
Yeah.
And I sold two books on the strength of that poem. I know. They bought the poem after that. One of them wasn't even interested in it to begin with at all. Knew nothing about it. And I thought, that's a try.
Well, I think that deserves applause. Well done. Now, it's over to you. Questions, observations, please.
Yes?
Has Alan Bennett been in touch?
Alan Bennett is... He is one of the vice presidents of the society, actually. And he did us the great favour of coming along... this was some time ago now, with Patrick Garland when he was still alive and doing a performance which earned the Larkin Society, which, of course, I'm literary advisor to. And you must look up on the internet and join. We need members. Please join the Philip Larkin Society. It's worth it. You get two issues of a newsletter every year, which I edit, and it's worth having. He is still in touch with us. We occasionally ask him to, to express support for things, and he's there. I think, you know, in the larger perspective, you know, the fact that I can fall out with him over that, and the fact that Maeve, you know, threw a fit when he... Basically, as a very active homosexual, he just got Philip's sex life wrong. He says, this is what offended Maeve, he said he would leave off his work in the library for a bit of beef jerky in the stacks with Maeve. Now, the relationship with Maeve was nothing like that at all. Mm. No beef jerky at all. Mm. But he's seeing it in the perspective of his own relationships, which are very hyperactive ones with men, which are often a lot of homosexuals alike. So he couldn't really see Larkin any differently. I don't know what I've never talked to him about this. I've met him and we've had polite conversation, but it would be interesting to know what he would say if one talked to him about it. Is that an answer? Yes. Sort of, yes.
Gentleman there with his hand up.
Thank you for your very interesting insight. The only thing I took issue with was you... I thought you were a bit harsh on Seamus Heaney.
Yes, people always do.
Yeah. He wrote a... this goes with me, but he wrote an essay about Larkin, which I think was called A Name of Light. I may be wrong.
Yes.
It's from The Governance of the Tongue, that anthology of it.
Yes.
In which he did something which I've never seen anybody else do, which is actually I've always held on to, which was seeking out Larkin's taste for what you might call the transcendent in
yes. Yes.
And going in search of it and finding it in
yes.
Sadler, for example, and
yes.
in quite a number of other poems as well. That's always stayed with me, because
yes.
it's not an aspect of Larkin's work that is often
no.
given much attention. So
Yeah.
On that particular point, yeah. I thought you were...
I think you're right, and you'll speak for a lot of readers like that. But from my perspective, and maybe I'm wrong here, but maybe I'm being perverse, but for me, that offended me, because I'd always known for decades before that Larkin was the transcendent one, and Heaney was a stodgy bloke stuck in the bog, only able to do little iconic poems, little kind of emblematic poems with morals to them, you know. Whereas Larkin is, but even more the glare of that. Most of what Heaney writes is a justification of not doing the bounding, syntactically spacious pentameter line or tetrameter line. Same as Hughes, it's the same kind of argument. They couldn't do what Larkin was doing. They're very jealous. So they make up a whole poetic of their own, which is based on emblems, poems which are objects in their own right, rather than expressive kind of communications, which is the Shakespeare or the Sylvia Plath version. Sylvia Plath is much more like Larkin than she's like Ted Hughes, which Ted Hughes perversely tries to deny. You read something like Birthday Letters, and Hughes tries to pretend that Sylvia Plath was a kind of metaphysical, priestly sort of poet like him, worshipping the... She wasn't at all. She was an expressive, secular poet like Larkin. That's partly the difference between them. That's why he couldn't cope with her either, because she was a better poet than him.
Yeah, I think you're right. Any others? Well, I've got one then.
Okay.
The gentleman talked about the transcendent aspect, and I think this is... You didn't actually have time to touch on this, really.
Okay.
And what I'm going to ask you is that from your researches, did you feel that Larkin had any... religious faith as such. I mean, I know when people always cite church going, yes, and they say, oh yes, deep down, yes, he was a closet Christian. Well, I rather doubt that, actually, but I don't know what you feel about it.
Yes, Patrick Garland was very much of that view, and I remember talking to him and thinking, I'm not going to get anywhere with this man, because he's just determined that to make Larkin into a fellow travelling Anglican. Larkin, of course, said that he was I'm an agnostic, but an Anglican agnostic, of course. He was, of course, quoting Houseman,
yes,
who said, I'm an atheist, yes, but an Anglican atheist.
Yes. Yes.
So he knew what he was doing, and Houseman's a good person to quote in that context. I think he wasn't an agnostic, I think he was an atheist. Agnostic is perhaps a better word for him to use, because unlike Houseman, he doesn't make it into some kind of principle with the way he writes. So perhaps it's more correct to call him agnostic. He would never take issue with it. But he did, however, take issue with critics, particularly the more academic critics, who argued that church-going was a religious poem. Mm. He said in an interview, I think it was, that some American had insisted that it was a religious poem. It is not a religious poem. Mm. If it were a religious poem, I would have some idea of divine supervalence of human activity, would I not? You know, there is nothing of that at all. When I go up to the church, I'm not familiar with any of the supposed theological force which is coming from it. And the force in the poem, when you look at it, comes from, in a very secular way, from the fact that so many dead lie around. If only that so many dead lie around. Mm. And he was quite insistent on that. I think he put his foot wrong in the poem. And it's partly, possibly, Monica Jones's fault. Monica is interesting. When I asked her point blank, you know, what do you make of religion? She said, well, half and half. But she was very old by that time. And I think she was actually quite conventional. And he writes to her about the poem. And when he gets to that elevated bit at the end, it's very difficult to work out whether he's being ironic or not. How does it get there? We were looking at it just now. What was it?
You were quoting it.
A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air our compulsions meet are recognized, our compulsions meet are recognized and robed as destinies. And you think, yeah, well, this is the liturgy and so on, which is supposed to, you know, sort of give meaning to your life. It's a way of putting it. It's a very Anglican way of putting it. Is it the Reverend Flannel in Private Eye, you know, having an off day, who's blent air? But then in a letter he says he loves the phrase blent air, and it's meant to sound beautiful. Mm. Blent air, I can't get it. I don't think... Mm. I can't quite work out where the edges of... And I don't think he could... And when it was picked on and made such a favourite anthology piece by so many people he knew, particularly there's one occasion where the sub-librarian, Brenda Moon, said it was her favourite poem.
Yes, yes.
And he looked a bit shocked and surprised and said if he'd have known it was going to be so favoured, he would have taken more trouble over it. And I think he means he would have sorted out this very ambiguous tone towards the end where you're not quite sure whether he's... And that gives the Anglican reader... the chance to think, oh, he really is on our side. But it only in the most cultural way, you know, not in any theological or even spiritual way, really. I mean, he believed, I think, like Houseman and like me, that the only spirituality is atheism. You don't get to spirituality at all until you get rid of theology. That's the sine qua non.
I think people like it principally because it's the bit about the bicycle clips.
Yes.
You know, that's...
In awkward reverence.
In awkward reverence. And he removes his bicycle clips, doesn't he? Yes, that's it. Yes, that's his gesture. So, anyway, well, I'm going to make a gesture to our speaker, James Booth, and it is one of great thanks. We've really enjoyed this. It's been very, very stimulating and lively and fun, and indeed has given more insight into Larkin. But to get the full lot, the full insight, read the book. It really is enthralling, I promise. So thank you very much, and thank you.
I've got the signing pen.